Welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rance. This is the part of the program where I'm supposed to be telling you what this week's show is all about. Well, in a nutshell, we're talking about our future. It's about how companies operating in the genetic trait business are using gene editing to support better outcomes for farmers.
Farmers are well aware of some of these goals out there. They're really what's important to them is managing their farms effectively and sustainably so that you can continue to really be productive and not, you know, have any damage to the environment around farms and on farms.
We'll hear about how farmers, food and beverage processors, and conservation groups are working to give consumers choices that support waterfowl habitat and the environment.
Our research further determined that ducks that nest in winter wheat are 24 times more successful than those who choose to nest in spring-sown cereals.
And finally, how our ability to find the people and the ideas to support agriculture and our rural communities is undeniably tied to reconciling with our past.
The definition of Indigenous wealth is very different in that it's about community.
But before we start, here's a word from our sponsor.
Part of being a farmer is being an accountant and a mechanic and a chemist. You have lots on the go. So FarmLink makes your grain marketing go further. We help you reach your financial goals with calculated sales decisions. No bias, just solutions and results. Plus, with our new app GrainFox, we bring every opportunity right to your fingertips. Literally. Start seeing the returns that'll get your family ahead. You've earned it. FarmLink. Your work is worth more. Get started at farmlinksolutions.ca.
Welcome back to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rance. Our first item takes us into the world of gene editing, a concept that still makes some people a little bit uncomfortable. In this story, the Western producer's Robin Booker attempts to demystify both the process and the potential of these new crop breeding tools. As part of Glacier Farm Media's Seeding the Future project, Robin talked to CBIS molecular biologist Peter Beetham about how gene editing is opening new pathways to crop improvement.
CBIS is based in San Diego. We're a company of about 120 people. Fundamentally, we're an independent trait developer. So we develop traits for crops. More recently, we're really focused now in on five crops and five trait areas. And so those five crops are canola, rice, corn, wheat, and soybean. With our first, our major focus in traits is what we call input traits. And so the ability to help farmers reduce their inputs. You know, those input traits for farmers, the three main areas we've been focusing on more recently are herbicide tolerance, disease tolerance, and nitrogen use efficiency. Fundamentally, what we're, one of our missions at CBIS is to really, provide new characteristics into, major crops globally that allow farmers to, make every acre more sustainable. And so that means, by reducing their need for inputs or making it simpler, that they farmers can increase their profits and also create more value per acre for seed companies and therefore royalties back to CBIS as part of the trade. Saskatoon's a centre of canola in Canada, and so our first foray as a company was in canola. We've showcased what we can do both as in elite seed and commercial seed. We actually had a seed business where we showcased some of our early trait canola, and more recently, we've divested some of those activities to Farmers Business Network, and now we're really a pure play gene editing independent trait developer. So when you look at the rapid trait development system, Robin, it's a family of technologies. It's not just one technology. We have been around for a number of years, and we've been building the infrastructure both in the lab and the greenhouses and then now to the field as well, to really show that we can truly make edits in genes in major crops. And fundamentally what we do is we make a spelling change in a gene. And so by doing that, we use the natural processes in cells of plants and then bring those cells back to a whole plant and then take it to the greenhouse, and then it enters into a normal plant breeding program. So it's the outcome is indistinguishable from what can occur in nature. The outcomes are very similar to what occurs in a traditional breeding program. And so, the ability to make those edits or spelling changes, and then that's what we call a genotype that could occur in nature given enough time, and then creates a new, essentially what that does is creates a new phenotype, which is a new characteristic. So, and, fundamentally traditional breeding or some of the older technologies like GMO have not been able to address disease tolerance like we can with gene editing.
Will farmers still have to spray once they get a variety that has this trait in it? Will they still have to spray for sclerotinia?
So right now we're on a path to producing increasing levels of tolerance. Last year, the USDA, we submitted a number of what they call MI-regulated documents to and eight of those, we did 14 in total, eight of them were to do with disease tolerance. So we have a number of targets. And the reason I'm telling you that is because right now, we think the initial introductions we see will reduce the amount of fungicide needed. It won't do it completely, but we think by the time we get to the final sort of next generation product, we could maybe eradicate the use of fungicide for sclerotinia or white mold completely. So, it really is progressive trait introduction. And, we're excited to see what we've done already in field trials. And this is just early stage trials. This is heading towards an understanding of when you get it, with our partners into commercial hybrids.
Do you have any time frame on when that might happen, of when this trait might be available for farmers?
We're looking, we're probably still four years away around. I would say, at best, we'll have more trials this year, and then one part of this is getting variety registration in Canada. So that takes a couple of years. So it's, it's that 3 to 4 year time frame. We'll know exactly when we launch.
Okay. Are there any other traits that you're working on in canola, and what's your goal with them?
So we've got a number of traits in canola. Right now, the initial work we did using a very early technology. We had herbicide tolerance. We've also now produced, with a more, what I would say is more specific gene editing, a pod shatter reduction trait that allows farmers at the end of the season to have some harvest flexibility. And so the pods on the canola plant don't shatter at harvest. That's a trait that is pretty well known for farmers with BASF, but a lot of the other seed companies have not had access to that. So we're bringing that to market through some partnerships. The next trait after that is the sclerotinia tolerance. And then the trait beyond that is another specific herbicide tolerance. When when we think about the constraints of farming as well as the disease, you know, controlling weeds is a big part of, you know, particularly in broad agriculture. So, you know, we're trying to address those issues by bringing alternatives and options for farmers for controlling their weeds. So we're looking forward to that. We're looking forward to the pod shatter reduction trait as well as disease. And these, you know, the exciting thing about gene editing is, you know, it fits perfectly into plant breeding programs and the traditional path to market. It also allows you to sort of combine those traits in a way that really meets what farmers would like to see and allows them some flexibility on how they manage their rotations, how they manage their crops. Yeah, look, I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, you're seeing more broadly in agriculture is, you know, commodity prices are improving. Farmers, you know, I think are looking to make every acre more productive. They're also, you know, really cognizant of keeping farming sustainable. And I think one of the things that Cibus is really committed to is working with seed industries around the world, but, you know, more specifically, you know, the early stages with canola in Canada and other places in North America, to really provide, you know, the ability to farmers to limit their inputs and therefore, you know, have less impact on the environment. There's a lot of push from governments around the world, Robin, to, you know, to reduce inputs by 50%. You know, there's a farm to fork initiative in Europe right now that allows the goal is to reduce inputs by 50% by 2030, and also be carbon neutral by 2050. So these, you know, I think farmers are well aware of some of these goals out there. You know, they're really, you know, what's important to them is managing their farms effectively and sustainably, so that you can continue to really be productive and not, you know, have any damage to the environment around farms and on farms. So, you know, we're really committed to work very closely with seed companies to provide traits into that channel so farmers can really meet some of those sustainability goals.
So I just recently did a story on peas and lentils here in Saskatchewan, and they're having a really tough time with the phantomyces. Might there be a role for this kind of technology to help peas and lentils get some tolerance or resistance to that disease?
Yeah, look, you know, one of the things that's really exciting about gene editing is once you understand some of the targets in one crop, they're very, you know, in a lot of cases, it's very transferable. So there's a transformational synergy between crops. So, you know, the various targets that I talked about before that we've looked at, we do see the ability to look at the same sorts of targets in other crops and then affect, in a positive way, tolerance to other diseases. Now, white mold is a good example because it's actually, it infects a lot of different crops. You know, it is in legumes. So, you know, that's in peas and soybean. And so, you know, that's an example of where we know we can use gene editing to be broader application across crops and therefore attack different diseases within those crops. So that's a long answer to say yes, but it gives you a little bit of understanding of why we see it as transferable. You know, it's an exciting time for ag. And ag tech with a lot of new technologies, and I think gene editing is going to be a major player, you know, in canola in Canada and other places around the world.
That was Robin Booker of The Western Producer talking to Peter Beetham of Cibus. If you're interested in learning more about our Seeding the Future multimedia project, you can view it online by doing a Google search for Glacier Farm Media Seeding the Future. You'll find stories, podcast interviews, videos, and animations that explore a wide variety of topics related to how we're protecting, managing, and developing our genetic resources. Our next item takes us into the wild, a wildlife education center on the outskirts of Winnipeg, that is. An assortment of farmers, waterfowl conservation groups, and industry gathered at the Fort White Center recently to launch a new labeling program. The Eco-Label is designed to support farmers who are choosing to grow duck-friendly crops. Here's Geraldine Witchers of the Manitoba Cooperator with that story.
Can a label on a bag of flour or a bottle of vodka boost the duck population? A new habitat-friendly winter wheat Eco-Label aims to try. Winter wheat makes ideal habitat for the northern pintail duck, which prefers to nest in cropland. Carly Reimer is a communications specialist with Ducks Unlimited Canada.
In the 1970s, we noticed populations of a duck species called the northern pintail were declining, mainly due to habitat loss. We decided to study these beautiful birds and found that unlike most waterfowl that need grasslands, pintails will choose cropland and field stubble to nest and raise their young. Our research further determined that ducks that nest in winter wheat are 24 times more successful than those who choose to nest in spring-sown cereals. This is because that field operations on farms are greatly reduced during peak nesting periods in the spring due to the fall-seeded nature of winter wheat.
Female pintails nest on the ground in low, sparse vegetation. They nest further from water than most ducks.
In the spring, when farmers are out on their land planting their crops, winter wheat is already in the ground growing, making it an attractive green blanket for ducks and other birds to build a nest. And it's not just ducks. Winter wheat provides habitat to several other grassland species as well. Moving forward, our new habitat-friendly Eco-Label can further showcase the environmental benefits of winter wheat while supporting Canada's agricultural sustainability goals and increasing a farmer's profitability.
However, winter wheat acres have been declining. In 2014, prairie farmers seeded 1.3 million acres. Last year, it was roughly a quarter of that, at 312,000 acres. The habitat-friendly label aims to make winter wheat a more attractive option. Daniel Ramage is the Director of Market Access and Trade Policy at Cereals Canada.
It really, at the heart of it, this is a market development project that's been driven from the ground up with support from the winter wheat producer commissions across the prairies who are looking to maintain winter wheat as a viable option for farmers, because we know that farmers want to keep winter wheat as an option within their rotations, and so they're looking for opportunities to help grow the demand for this crop. And so this project is one of the ways that we can help achieve that by communicating these important habitat benefits that we've known for a long time are made available by growing winter wheat, communicating that story back to the consumer. That's something that is ultimately going to help create these opportunities for farmers to keep winter wheat as an option within their rotation, but also to capture additional value if we are creating stronger demand pull.
The project is working with two companies so far: specialty miller Les Moulins de Solange and distiller Beam Suntory.
We're working with food manufacturers who are using the Eco-Label and are increasing their use of winter wheat in order to use the eco-label. They want to demonstrate their sustainability credentials. And so by using winter wheat and using this eco-label, that's one way they can achieve that. And so ultimately, with that increase in demand for winter wheat, that can transfer back to the farmer, that can create more value and more benefits for farmers who are growing winter wheat. It's giving them options and places where they can sell this crop beyond, you know, the usual destinations for winter wheat.
Ecolabel certification confirms the product uses Canadian Western Red winter class wheat. It does not carry a premium for farmers. The project is betting that food processors will take up the habitat-friendly label and thus boost demand. As farmers fill demand, pintail ducks may find more friendly fields to build their nests.
That story was brought to us by Geraldine Witchers, a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator. Our final item this week zeroes in on the efforts of Indigenous nations in Saskatchewan to work more closely with the agriculture sector in ways that both support their communities and the industry's growth. I spoke with Thomas Benjo, the CEO of FHQ Developments. Now, FHQ Developments was founded by the 11-member First Nations communities of File Hills Qu'Appelle Tribal Council. The council represents over 15,000 First Nations citizens and 435,000 acres of reserve lands in Treaty 4 territory, which encompasses much of southern Saskatchewan. Thomas and I talked about a recent conference held by FHQ that highlighted both the opportunities and the barriers their efforts face. Here's Thomas.
Our function here is three things. One, we invest and develop partnerships and build new businesses as an organization. So we have 12 companies that we actually manage in our portfolio. We have an economic development function, which is how we build the Indigenous business ecosystem around the success that we have in our businesses. And, you know, how are we bringing our nations and our citizen entrepreneurs along on the journey with us? And then the third piece is our Tokata HR Solutions, which focuses on Indigenous careers, either that's through building careers with us in our companies or with some of the organizations that we're putting talent to work. And we also do HR consulting as well. So all of those pieces together creates a bit of a lot more impact in our communities in terms of economic impact and social impact. Because our reach is much further than just looking at the bottom line. The definition for wealth, you know, it's typically, what am I doing for myself? What am I doing for, you know, the legacy I'm going to leave for myself or my family? The definition of Indigenous wealth is very different in that it's about community. So how are we improving the community? How are we leaving things sustainable for future generations? How are we making this better for livelihood that is going to be built off of the success we have in business? And so that's, you know, the whole premise of our organization is making sure that we're you know, sustainable and creating community wealth. And so that requires us to look a bit more broadly on how we measure success as an organization. What we are trying to hit home here is that there are so many more opportunities in the ag industry than, you know, just looking at the opportunities we have, you know, in our history as Indigenous businesses. So I mean, typically we're involved in, you know, more on the producer side of things. So we're raising cattle, we're growing crops, but now the opportunity at hand, and especially in our backyard in southern Saskatchewan, is we have a protein supercluster We have quite a number of new protein crushing plants that are coming in. And, you know, there's this amazing wave of ag tech that is happening that, you know, we need to be a part of. So it's exposing our nations to those opportunities, but also those organizations that are growing around us, these businesses in the ag industry, to think about their future. Think about, what does the future talent of their organization, what does the future supply chain of their organizations look like? Because if they're going to, if they plan to grow in Saskatchewan, you can't forget how important Indigenous people are going to be in that future plan because of the amount of growth that our population has as nations. And we're going to make up a pretty significant part of the overall Saskatchewan population going into the future. So you have to have a strategy in place, and it could be small things at the start, but get a bit more serious about the policies and the strategy going forward. So that's really what was the message we were trying to get across. But it's also, how do we identify some of the issues and barriers that are that exist because of policy or lack of policy? You know, we need to be able to understand these things, come up with solutions together, and try to build success with one another, and do that through partnership and relationship building. So those are really the foundations of, you know, why we held this conference and, you know, where we're going to take it into the future. You know, the Indian Act is probably one of the biggest barrier, biggest policy barriers that our nations would face, because it doesn't allow for security to be taken on any Indigenous property on reserve. And so, you know, you look at the basis of any loan, it's, you know, leveraging assets and, you know, leveraging land to be able to access capital, right, for loans. So, you know, if a bank can't take security on those assets, well, you know, chances are they're likely not going to lend to you. So, you know, we have to work through some of those issues, but also, you know, just make sure that our nations are aware, you know, when do these businesses make sense to be on reserve, and when do these businesses make sense to be off reserve and on fee simple land, where we can leverage the assets and use those for the capital that we need for our companies and for the growth. So I think there was a number of things that were discussed, I think, from the financial panel. And I know, you know, in discussions leading up to the panel, I did, you know, let our financial panel know that, you know, there are things that we need to start considering, you know, from a policy perspective, not only as financial institutions, but as government. You know, maybe we create a loan loss fund that, you know, can help backstop some of the lending that may happen. I'm a former commercial banker, and I know the numbers in terms of, you know, what loan losses actually look like for Indigenous communities. And, you know, you'd be quite surprised to learn that, you know, Indigenous lending is actually has the least amount of loan loss than any other industry. So, you know, there's always this stigma of putting out capital, not being able to get your returns, or, you know, be able to have any control over that funding. But at the end of the day, those little risks that have been taken have actually gone a long way for Indigenous communities. So, you know, we got to change the way we risk profile, I guess, in Indigenous investment. And I think once we do that, and perhaps have some backstop opportunities with government, I mean, that's what a lot of industries have been based on anyways. So why not do that for Indigenous communities as well? And I think, you know, that will solve our access to capital issues. But it's going to take a lot of people to change, and a lot of policies to change for that to happen. I think, you know, the one thing that the industry, you know, has not, you know, fully participated in reconciliation, or there's never been that push for the industry to participate in economic reconciliation. And, you know, when you're looking at the mining industries, oil and gas industry, pipeline, those natural resources, you know, in order for those projects to be able to go forward within, you know, our territories, there is a social license that they have to be able to sign off on. And so that means, you know, Indigenous engagement, Indigenous procurement, all of these things have to happen in order for that project to go forward, which, you know, does affect communities and does create, you know, a pretty significant impact. But, you know, never has the ag industry been put in that position to have to do anything like that. And so, you know, what we're asking the ag industry is to make considerations to start, you know, developing their Indigenous engagement strategies and procurement policies, you know, not to just, you know, check the box, but to actually create impact in the places where they are doing business. You know, it's, you know, to, in order to maintain that, you know, future success of your business, it's really important that the community around you is successful as well. And, you know, if that community around you is made up of a majority of Indigenous people, you know, having those strategies in place will benefit your business over the long term. And, you know, you look at some of the major projects that are going to go forward in Saskatchewan right now, and we're already talking, you know, labor shortages for most of these major projects. And I'm the chair of the Saskatchewan Chamber of Commerce as well. So I hear these issues day in and day out in our business community, just, you know, in general. So, you know, I often challenge back and say, well, what policies or what, you know, strategies do you have around Indigenous engagement? Because, you know, every company should be talking about this. And, you know, it's a perfect way to fit into their goals around economic reconciliation.
That was Thomas Benjo, the Chief Executive Officer of FHQ Developments based in Regina. You can learn more about the reconciliation process as it relates to agriculture in rural Canada by checking out our Truth and Reconciliation page. Just do a Google search for Glacier Farm Media Truth and Reconciliation. That's all we have for you on this week's edition of Between the Rows. Remember, you can find us on YouTube by searching for Between the Rows podcast. Using the word podcast in that search is important. And please check out our Seeding the Future and Reconciliation coverage by searching for those projects on the Glacier Farm Media digital site. We'll be back with another episode of Between the Rows next week. I hope you'll be back too. I'm Laura Rance.
Part of being a farmer is being an accountant and a mechanic and a chemist. You have lots on the go. So FarmLink makes your grain marketing go further. We help you reach your financial goals with calculated sales decisions. No bias, just solutions and results. Plus, with our new app GrainFox, we bring every opportunity right to your fingertips. Literally. Start seeing the returns that'll get your family ahead. You've earned it. FarmLink. Your work is worth more. Get started at farmlinksolutions.ca.